for a week or two at a time.
I went to the Rainbow Gathering once, and I remember showing up. Everyone says, welcome home.
Welcome home.
As you show up there.
That's right. And I think Burning Man.
One that I've seen from being in is the, you know, like, get unity. You deliver who you stress.
And in the mornings, all go in the community for each other, really witness each other, interacting and enjoying and connecting with and maybe struggling through things with other people in the world together. There's something there.
Hmm. Yeah.
I was going to just, the my wife and I found kind of a sideways integration of that. We both work from home. Mm-hmm. So our commute is just like out the back door.
Uh-huh.
And so the girls have, you know, seen it, what we do and how we're really working with people and mm-hmm. from the get-go. That's,
yeah.
It's unique, though. We really had to work to create that.
And living at Grub, Maya and Corinne and the other kids on the farm got to watch people do all kinds of things that I mean, I wasn't even a part of some of it, like raising goats and pigs and growing food and chickens. All these things that they got to witness the adults doing and working. And it makes me think of kind of olden times when families used to all live on the farm and the kids would grow up and watch their parents work, or mm-hmm. in indigenous societies they would be together all day and see and witness what it was like for the adults to go through life. And in our modern world, most kids don't have that nearly as much.
Wow.
The work environment and then what kids witness are very separated.
Right. I got really excited when you posed that question, because I didn't get to see my parents outside the house, really, like, interact with really very many people, like, maybe my neighbors, but, like, again, my mother was from another country, her English wasn't always that great, it's much, much better now, my dad has been ill most of my life, and so, just not really, like, that too much social interaction, and so, my view of my parents was, like, the view in the house, you know, like, how they behaved in the house. And what's interesting, because when I talk to them about, like, sort of my personality and how it's, like, developed from, you know, my parents raising me, it's like, I didn't know my parents were shy. Yeah. I mean, like, and probably for most people that know me, wouldn't think that I had parents that were really shy, because because I wanted to be a radio host, you know. Yeah, like, I learned these things after, as an adult, seeing my parents interact with people outside of the home and seeing my mother, like, in work settings and things like that. I was like, oh, wow, like, okay. Like, I guess I get that now, but I never saw my parents that way because of the way they were in home, like, that disconnection that you're talking about, the way in home versus the way in work. So I think it serves to talk about how we disconnect ourselves sometimes when we are performing a certain role in society.
And this leads into my philosophical tangent. One of my mentor, or, you know, the author that really affected me is Eric Fromm, and he had this beautiful book that's written back in the 40s or 50s called Escape from Freedom. And he was saying how when we were in these olden times, you're saying, where, like I was saying before, it's in our body. Like 99.9% of the human experience has been in villages and communities and tribe, you know, was like, we know how that feels. And so this weird disconnection that we're having now, it's obviously it's a product of our industrial society, industrialized culture and society, which allows a very fine compartmentalization of work, like the type of work that my daughters might be doing hasn't been invented yet, you know, like if we were in olden times, they'd see their dad working acupuncture, Chinese herbs, and they'd learn how to be a herbalist and an acupuncturist. That was mm-hmm. like required. You'd follow the family tradition. But we need so much more flexibility in our workforce as an industrialized culture, that there had to be the sacrifice of that tribal village feeling. Yeah. So it's like we really have to intend and recreate that which was actually something more natural, like returning to something that's more natural. And the forms that takes, you know, intentional community and community focus itself, and these festivals and immersions and ways to rehumanize yourself, whatever you're finding, it's part of the paradigm shift. Boom.
Yes. And Adam, I know that at least one of your daughters goes to Inspire High School, as do my boys, and Grace plans to go there too. And, you know, although it is separated, you know, because it's a high school and the parents aren't, you know, they aren't fully involved and it's not families together, but it seems like they're touching on kind of a tribal feeling there where, you know, it's a smaller school, it's only 500 kids,
yeah.
And it's totally normal to just be who you are, and it's a very accepting, non-judgmental environment,
mm-hmm.
and there's just, you know, the especially if the kids are involved with musicals, like I know both of our kids are, it's nurturing, and they have mentors, and it's such a community feeling from what I can see.
That was one of the reasons we moved to Chico, was the Blue Oak Waldorf School. It was a charter school just starting up, and that school and then the Montessori School, Inspire, all these have been wonderful. You know, we make lifelong friends from our daughter's friends. That's the thing with the parenting, that they just naturally bring more community in.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about another way, another kind of way of thinking about community, and that is, I know, Jonah, you know, you and I teach nonviolent communication, and part of our work is building an empathy network in, you know, locally, and it's kind of like counseling, but it's not, because it's just a way of being with each other that I think people used to know how to do before we were so isolated. It's a deep kind of connecting, non-judgmental, loving. It's kind of a deep kind of way of being present with each other, and so you know, you can get together with someone and walk in the park, or you can have several different empathy buddies and just get this really, really quality emotional support. And I see that as having been part of my healing journey as an isolated parent. I set up several empathy buddies a week when I think my oldest was about 13. And I realized that being isolated had sort of put me into a state of shame, because I didn't know... I had a child who was really struggling with some special needs, and I didn't know how to reach out and accept help. I just got more and more isolated, and I realized that I was full of shame about my child and about my parenting and about my inability to handle it all. And I started talking with my empathy buddies several times a week, and I just burned through that shame, and I came out of it, and I was able to start seeing people as, you know, I started to be open to asking for help, and I started to just feel so much more full, you know, mm-hmm. and able. So I see making a grassroots empathy network as something that could be very powerful. Mm-hmm. For everyone in all walks of life, but especially for families and parents.
I love that description. You burned through your shame.
Yeah, and you never go back. Like, once you burn through it, it's over.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of have this belief that we living in the world in the way that we do, with this kind of separateness in our families growing up, and just being in such large cities surrounded by Sorry, I apologize. We're having some technical difficulties. Living in communities with such a large amount of people and going to school with lots and lots of other kids, that we develop these patterns around hiding and holding things in, and shame around all kinds of things, including even having emotions or struggling. And we'll go through periods where so many of us struggle to even ask for help, because needing help is such a shameful thing, or it shows weakness. And that's one of the values I see with community, is when we, like, real community, like that felt sense of community, is when we have people where we're not hiding from anymore. Who when we're struggling, they see it, and we see other people struggling, and that struggle even in itself isn't even that bad of a thing. It's just part of life, and we just watch each other and support each other go through it like it's not a big deal. And living that way is, for me, like learning to live that way and find community and have more of a transparent lifestyle is just so much for overall well-being.
Mm-hmm. Empathy to the rescue.
So I want to say again, we have a little bit more time. If there's anyone out there who would like to call in and comment, that is always an option. The phone number is, let's see, 895-1114. So, Corinne.
Yeah?
I'm curious for you. You've grown up in a way where you lived a part-time in an intentional community. You also have a mother, and you spent a lot of time with your grandparents. So you have lots of different adults in your life. I'm curious if your sense of how that's been for you.
It's been a little confusing because I have to go to house to school, but normally we have a routine, like I go to like my mom, dad, grandparents, mom, dad, grandparents, like a routine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's helpful, and it's also hard to like if my birthday is in a week and everyone wants to know what time, and I still don't know with everyone, and I need to check in with everyone. Mm-hmm. So
we have to communicate with all those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely people out there, I know, out in the world that want to call us right now. So I just want to repeat that number one more time, 895-1114. I was just talking with Maximus. I'm not sure if he's going to be calling us back, but he was somebody that called in before on a previous show, and is, I believe he teaches something about communication at Butte College, and he really enjoys the show. So I'm going to get him on the line here in a second.
Okay. Is he calling in right now? Hi, Maximus, are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Katie.
Oh, okay. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. Yeah, thank you so much for this topic. I just wanted to say I'm a mom of two young kiddos, and I've definitely felt the stress of craving more community. And I think that looking back in history, I'm definitely not a history buff, but I feel like we kind of traded our closeness as a family and as a community for a paycheck.
Mm.
And we, you know, we went out to the city to chase all these jobs thinking that there were these big American dreams attached, but we found ourselves feeling really empty. And I think it's the next step in our personal and social evolution, mm-hmm. to kind of go back to that community feeling, because I've been really called to that, and I speak to so many who are called to that as well. So anyway, thanks so much for the topic. Really appreciate it.
So kind.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. And glad to hear that this felt meaningful for you.
Totally. Anyway, I'll let you try to get Maximus, but thanks. Right. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Okay, we got Cedar Rhodes back on the line as well, and I know that Maximus said he was going into a class, so he may not have the time to get on the air. But yeah, Cedar, did you have some thoughts that you wanted to share?
Yeah, no, I'm just...
Oh, I think we just lost her again.
Yeah, that was different.
Oh, was that different?
Yeah.
I'm still here.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I've just been thinking about the different ways that we can find that reconnection, and it seems like that's the work for all of us, is reclaiming community, reclaiming ourselves, reclaiming our connection.
Yeah. I loved hearing what the last caller just shared of the, like, choosing a paycheck over connection. It seems to be a common experience in our modern society, and kind of what we're taught growing up is that that's what's valuable, is having money. And it definitely there's no denying that we do need money. And one thing I've found is that through creative ways, like living in intentional community or sharing resources or having close neighbors, that there are ways of getting by and getting our needs met that are based more on connection and shared. And there's the concept of a gift economy and things like that. And I'm excited to explore this
more than just the concept.
Yeah, there's a
gift economy. Again, like 99.9% of the human experience was in that. And then in the last, you know, minute of the hour of the day of the human experience was barter and then monetary. So when I was in the Rainbow Gathering, everything is gift, everything is given. And it just feels so good. You know, it feels so natural.
So we've got Annie calling in. Mm. Annie, are you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here. Hello.
Hi.
Hey. It's a thing, y'all, on the radio community.
Yeah.
Hear an echo. I turn off.
Oh, is it still there? It might be, if your radio is on, it could be feedback through your phone.
Yeah, it's more just hearing the echo of.
Okay.
But I just wanted to share and just also say hi and just let you know I was listening and
everything.
Great. But one of my experiences of living in community as a mom and with a child, seems like there's little pockets of communities. And she go, like, mm-hmm. like you guys sort of mentioned Happy Corner, and there was Grub, and sorry, that's not there, but there is also co-housing, and I lived there with my son for a while, and I thought it was a really good experience as far as the kids, you know, being kind of in a safe community that they could have a lot of eyes on them and stuff like that in the community. And it was a different, what I found was very different with where I'd lived previously. as far as its structure and its organization, was so different. Like where I had lived up at the Chico Goddess Temple way back when.
Yeah.
And that was a bit disjointed and not so organized. It was a beautiful vision of a place, but when I lived in co-housing, it was quite the opposite as far as meetings and organization. It was almost the other extreme, but also a lot of really intelligent people with a lot of background and intentional community. So I really appreciated that experience as well. Now I'm kind of back to living in my own house and sort of trying to create some, you know, community as far as with like my back neighbor and the people just geographically where I live as well, but working on that. But I do miss living in more of a community. But and I noticed like what Tamara shared, I think my son has become more of the kind of only child not so social, whereas I think when having more interaction with more people and adults, you know, is a valuable experience. So I hope he can get more of that at some point.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, just wanted to share and say hi.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in. I was thinking about what you said about you lived in two different communities, and one of them was the goddess temple that ended up not working out, it sounds like, and as I shared at the Grub Cooperative, we ended up having to end at one point. And I think that what's coming to mind is just the reality of that a lot of us don't exactly know how to do this, and it's really a creative process when living at Grub for six years, and it existed for 7 years, and it would have continued, but we had some things with the landlord, circumstances.
Yeah, and I remember, Joni, you were so supportive when I was thinking about applying to live there, and
right, yeah.
Next to you available, that would have been really cool. Anyway,
it would have been great. Yeah, but there's something about it's really a creative process. We don't necessarily grow up with the tools for living in communities, or even creating communities so much, or
with
like
learning,
or things like leadership, or how to make decisions as a group. We're used to kind of more business structures where there's a boss that makes the decision, or some kind of head person, and I think there's lots of challenges to it. It doesn't just come together so easily, and sometimes they fail or it doesn't work for whatever reason. But I think for me, my experience is that it was so worth it.
It was just all of the
learning and the growth and the love and the connection. It's this really valuable endeavor, those of us who are working towards that.
And if this is putting a bee in your bonnet for all those folks out there, there's resources. There's the Foundation for Intentional Community that produces a newsletter or online resource for communities and cooperatives that are forming or that are existing, and that's all over the world. It's in our backyard, and that's a one way you can find folks who are also doing this.
What's that, Adam, again?
And I don't have the actual name of it. I'd have to look it up, but it's
a website.
Yeah, it's a foundation for or association for intentional community.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if you just Google it, it comes up. So
yeah,
Intentional Communities International Foundation. You'll find some information, and simple tip too is like go meet your neighbors. If you don't know them yet, then go introduce yourself. If you have that inkling to like go to that book club that you've been looking at, like take a risk and go out and meet some new people. You'll be surprised what the opportunity will reward you with.
Another thing that comes to mind is those of us with kids, oftentimes our kids start making friends at school and want to spend time with their friends, and sometimes the friends as parents might be fun people too, and making a double family date and all go to the park together or something is a nice way to bond as a big, large family social community unit.
Sounds good.
I have an example that's been really beautiful in my life, and it seems like the overarching theme that makes it work is the idea of taking back our lives from institutions. Those institutions that might not be serving us. And I homeschooled my kids all the years until they went to high school. And we made a network of homeschooling families and unschooling families who met weekly and often way more often than that. And it was the parents involved with the kids and all ages, and the kids learned to interact with people of all ages. And we formed our own community. And it was very, very enriching. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of the Chapmantown projects that we're doing with our intentional community here, you know, the idea of taking down fences between houses and planting fruit and nut trees on all the empty lots, mm-hmm. and, you know, things like that, where we reclaim our food as well, yeah. and our well-being and our sense of community here.
Chapman's really uppity. Love living there.
So it's been such a pleasure to have you on. Thank you, Cedar Rose, for being a part of the conversation. We got to segue now into the next hour here. Ecotopia is coming up next. Stay tuned. It is sure to be an entertaining hour with Susan and Steve. Thank you, Adam, for joining. And thank you for bringing your girls, Jonah. It really brings a dynamic appeal when we can have the voices of our youth in the studio. We'll see you next Tuesday, 5 o'clock, talking about love and family.
How curious that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died in, of all places, an exclusive West Texas hunting lodge. Curiouser yet, all expenses for his honor's February stay were paid by the lodge's owner, John Poindexter. He's a Houston manufacturing mogul who had won a favorable ruling from the court in an age discrimination case last year. In another curiosity, the names of some 35 other people who were in Scalia's hunting party are being kept secret. Moreover, the late judge, an ardent promoter of corporate supremacy over people's rights, was flown to the Texas getaway for free aboard someone's or some corporation's private jet. But the name of this generous benefactor has also been withheld. Curious, huh? This is not a murder mystery. By all accounts, Scalia died of natural causes. Rather, it's a moral mystery. Who was buying, or repaying, favors from such an enormously powerful member of America's highest court? There's a bit of poetic justice in the fact that Justice Scalia, in particular, passed away under such circumstances, for his expiration exposes a little-known ethical loophole through which moneyed interests can curry special favors from supremes, judicial junkets. The West Texas hunting excursion was hardly Scalia's first freebie. He has been the most frequent Supreme Court traveler on conflict of interest airlines, accepting more than 280 privately paid-for jaunts in the past dozen years to luxury destinations, including Hawaii, Hong Kong, Palm Springs, and Switzerland. This is Jim Hightower saying, every lower court judge is subject to a formal code of conduct, but the 9 top court judges have exempted themselves from it. Scalia's inconvenient demise in the desert shows why we can't trust them to self-police their integrity. For more information, go to fixthecourt.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.